Greetings and thrarial hedemifications, my somnolent listeners. Welcome to this April 2020 Science News Update. I'm your host for this naively Pollyannic podcast, Jim Campanella. Amid a resolution, ladies and germs, and yes, I'm using germs in the most ironic way possible. In the coming weeks, as long as I can continue to provide you with this little monthly tidbit, I will no longer be mentioning anything at all about the present health crisis. I decided this all on the basis of the relative percentage of news that is devoted at all levels about the health crisis. I'm here to entertain, educate, amuse. I ain't here to pander. I am not here to scare. At the moment, we are getting little happy news, whether that be in relation to science or not. I intend this to be perhaps not the happiest segment on the internet, but at least one where you do not have to hear about the same stuff that you hear about everywhere else. I was listening to the BBC News the other day, and it horrified me that I was actually pleased to hear a story about a war somewhere. I mean, that is how totally invasive, pervasive reports about the present crisis have become. If you could be pleased to hear about anything other than the pandemic, even a war in Africa, that just is getting to the point of being bloody scary. So this is now a pandemic-free zone. Idiot scientists? Hey, sure, why not? They're always out there. The Journal of the Scientist reported last week on this story, written by Catherine Offord. Prominent geneticist Dr. Konstantin Stratakis has said he will not take up the position of executive director and chief scientific officer of the Research Institute of McGill University Health Center in Montreal, after allegations of gender discrimination during his previous job came to light in a Science News article on April 2nd. Stratakis has, for the last 10 years, directed the Division of Intramural Science at the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, I assume that's Canada, and has been the subject of eight equal employment opportunity complaints against him since 2013. Oops. A McGill University spokesman said, quote, "The board of directors of the Research Institute of McGill University Health Center acknowledged today Dr. Konstantin Stratakis' decision to withdraw from his research institute and associated appointments at the Research Institute and McGill University. Dr. Stratakis, who was scheduled to take up his responsibilities on June 1, 2020, confirmed that circumstances beyond his and his family's control forced him to reconsider their future," unquote. Science reported that researchers at the National Institute spoke of the low number of women running labs during Stratakis' tenure there. Between 2011, when Stratakis became the permanent scientific director, and 2020, the percentage of labs run by women fell from 27% to 23%, both lower than the proportions at other leading children's research hospitals, which ranged between 30 to 47%. Again, oops. The article related accounts of disrespectful and demeaning behavior toward women in the division by Stratakis. Of the eight complaints brought against him since 2013, three were dropped, lost, or dismissed, three were settled, and the remaining two are ongoing. Dr. Lynette Neiman of the National Institute told Science, quote, "Konstantin Stratakis does not value the diversity, perspective, and contributions that women bring to the table as physicians and scientists. That has shown in his actions and how he treats women and his poor record in enhancing the diversity of the Institute," unquote. Stratakis told Science in a response, quote, "The National Institute Intramural Program is highly supportive of women. Nine of the division's 10 clinical investigators who don't run labs are women." He then went on to state that some of his best friends are women. Yes, that was a joke. Dr. Aaron Wolf, another researcher who filed an equal employment opportunity complaint against Stratakis, tells Science this week in a follow-up article that she is happy about the news Tritakis won't be taking the new job. She told Science, "I'm pleased that his withdrawal will not give him a fresh opportunity to stifle the careers of women scientists and scientists who do women's health research," unquote. Given that we've been talking about women, why not do the first story, and that's going to be about women. Why do women live longer than men? I guess that's about women. All right, it's about women and men, fine. I could make some smart aleck statement about why women live longer than men, but that would just get me in trouble. New research published last month in Biology Letters suggests that having two copies of the same chromosome, the X, in the case of humans, may offer protection and lead to a longer lifespan. Differences in lifespan between sexes have been observed in many different species, though not always in the same direction. In mammals, females tend to outlive males, while in birds, the opposite seems to be true. Although a popular theory has labeled risky male behavior as the cause in humans, new research has suggested it may have to do more with our sex chromosomes. Dr. Zoe Zirakostas from the University of South Wales tested something called the unguarded X hypothesis. That concept suggests that the reduced or absent sex chromosome, the Y chromosome in mammals, and the W chromosome in birds, fails to protect an individual from deleterious mutations on the other sex chromosome, in the case of humans, the X. The hypothesis has been around for years, but no one has ever actually tested whether it's true. Zirakostas' study is the first to put the hypothesis to a test. Significantly expanding the phylogenetic span of species examined by compiling and analyzing female and male longevity for 229 species across 99 families, 38 orders, and 8 classes on the tree of life. Zirakostas says, quote, "We looked at lifespan data in not just primates and other mammals and birds, but reptiles, fish, amphibians, arachnids, cockroaches, grasshoppers, beetles, butterflies, and moths, among others," unquote. Her analysis revealed that across a broad range of species, the homogametic sex lives, on an average, 17.6% longer than the heterogametic sex. So let me explain. Homogametic means that the sex has the same two chromosomes. So in humans, XX is homogametic. Heterogametic means that you have two different chromosomes, sex chromosomes. So in humans, XY is the heterogametic sex. So this discovery does provide support for the unguarded X hypothesis. The researchers also identified substantial differences in the lifespan dimorphism between female heterogametic species and male heterogametic species. So in species where females have two of the same sex chromosomes, for example, humans and all mammals, females live on an average 20.9% longer than males. However, in species where the male has two sex chromosomes, for example, birds and butterflies and moths, the males outlive the females by only 7%. This finding suggests that while sex chromosomes may play a role, there seems to be something else fundamentally life-shortening about being male. And again, I can say something really snarky here, but that would just get me in hot water. Zirakostas finishes with, quote, "I was only expecting to see a pattern of the homogametic sex, XX or ZZ, living longer. So it came as an interesting surprise to see that the type of sex determination system, XXXY or ZZZW, could also play a role in an organism's longevity," unquote. By the way, ZZZW is what you see in birds. Male birds are ZZ, female birds, ZW. Zirakostas suggests that increased degradation of the Y chromosome, or the protective value of estrogen, or risky male behavior, during sexual selection could be responsible for this trend. Now, here's a thought, Dr. Zerikostas, and it may seem like a really stupid idea, but it occurred to me you may want to look at the lifespans of male to female or female to male transsexuals, humans. Even though they no longer make high levels of their birth hormones, they still have their original sex chromosomes. If it is true that high levels of estrogen are protective, then male to female transsexuals may live longer on average, and female to male transsexuals may lose years of life along with their estrogen. It's a thought. Although her study provides the first evidence to support the unguarded X hypothesis, the results only suggest more studies are probably needed. And you think that this stuff is kind of silly, but it's important for understanding the mechanism of longevity. I mean, it may lead us to a much better understanding of aging and treatment of aging. We're not looking for immortality drugs here, but anything that will help people survive to an older age in a more healthy state will be really great. Next up, a lens the size of the sun. What? What does that mean? I'll tell you. A couple of weeks ago, NASA's Innovative Advanced Concept, NIAC, program announced that they will spend the next year developing space mission concepts that sound like they were plucked straight from a Starship sofa story. Among this year's NIAC grants is an eye-popping concept headed by Dr. Slava Turishev, a physicist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, who wants to photograph an exoplanet by using the sun as a giant camera lens. If that isn't the proposal for an awesome story, I don't know what is. Now, remember, exoplanets are light years away. We can't even get a decent photo of Pluto without traveling there. But this bunch thinks that they can see an exoplanet? Now, the idea is based on a century-old theory first suggested by Einstein, who calculated the star's gravity could cause light from another star to bend around it, effectively creating a giant lens. If you were to stand at the focal region where the bent light converges, the solar gravitational lens would significantly magnify whatever was behind it. Einstein's theory about gravitational lensing, well, it's now well known, and it's been shown to be absolutely true. And in fact, observational cosmologists regularly use the gravitational lensing from galaxies and galaxy clusters to study more distant objects. Turishev's plan would take advantage of this effect by sending a rocket with a telescope attached on a 60 billion mile journey to the sun's focal region to photograph a habitable Earth-like exoplanet that might be, well, up, they say, up to 100 light-years away. Turishev calculates that sending a telescope just one-third the size of the Hubble Space Telescope to the sun's focal region could produce a megapixel-quality image of an exoplanet after a few years of snapping photos. If the targeted exoplanet is about the size of Earth, each pixel would cover about 35 square kilometers. Turishev says that would be better resolution than the famous Earthrise photo taken by Apollo 8 astronauts, and more than enough definition to make out surface features and signs of life on the exoplanet's surface. Now, I'm not a physicist, but really, why don't I have much confidence in this? All right, trying to justify all the work involved, Turishev says, quote, "The primary motivation for everyone contributing to this project is to move the idea from science fiction to reality so that the current generation of people living on this planet can enjoy images of an alien world. Are we alone? Is a question we all ask, and we may be able to answer that within our lifetime," unquote. It's been pointed out by other NASA scientists that, cool as this would be, the technological challenges involved are staggering. First, consider the distance. We're talking 60 billion miles. That's 16 times farther from the sun than Pluto, ladies and gentlemen. If you're traveling at the speed of light, it would take 3 days to get there. 3 days. 3 light days. That is not exactly close. Voyager 1, which has ventured farther into interstellar space than any other human-made object, has only traveled 13 billion. Now, think about that. It's taken it 40 years to get 13 billion miles. So when Tereshev says, within our lifetime, he is not talking about my lifetime here, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking probably longer than 40 years. I will be worm food in 40 years. What else? Well, simply getting the spacecraft to the right place is a major challenge. Unlike a camera lens, the sun doesn't have a single focal point, but a focal line that starts around 50 billion miles away and extends into space infinitely, from what I've read. The image of an exoplanet can be reimagined as a tube, like a mile in diameter, centered on that focal line and located 60 billion miles away in the vast emptiness of interstellar space. The telescope has to align itself perfectly within that tube so you can draw an imaginary line from the center of the telescope through the center of the sun to a region on the exoplanet. To image the exoplanet, the telescope moves within the tube, taking a photo at each new position, and that represents a new view of the exoplanet's surface. Since each position corresponds to one pixel in the final image, the telescope has to point with extreme accuracy and maintain that accuracy for exposure times anywhere from a few minutes to hours. Good luck with accomplishing that with a camera hanging out in what is essentially interstellar space. And no, ladies and gentlemen, it doesn't just end there. When the sun's gravity magnifies an object, it doesn't produce a coherent picture like a camera lens. Instead, you get a smeared image. It's around the edge of the sun in a halo called the Einstein ring. And that halo appears inside the sun's corona. Remember the sun's corona, that fiery outer atmosphere? And that just distorts the image and overwhelms it with lots of brightness, let's say. And each Einstein ring corresponds to one pixel in the final image and contains a mixture of reflected light from a small region of the exoplanet's surface and the rest of the planet. To capture the full image, the telescope has to pick out the faint signal from the Einstein ring against the overwhelming background noise of the sun's corona. It has to extract the signal, and then it has to de-blur that using computer algorithms to recover the relevant data. And to get an entire image, I mean, that process has to be done a million times. It has to be repeated over and over and over again, literally a million times. And, well, yes, we're still not done. Finally, there's the problem of what the heck is this guy going to focus on? Think about it. Given the amount of time and material resources that are going to be needed to make this happen, and we're talking lots of money here, we don't want to just take a photo of a cold, dead world that looks like, well, Pluto or Mars, for that matter. I mean, nobody wants to see another Mars. But of the thousands of exoplanets discovered to date, only a few have any properties that make them potentially habitable. And that means that these planets are rocky, about the size of the Earth, and they orbit their host star at a distance that allows for liquid water to exist on their surfaces. The technological constraints of the mission mean that the planet has to be located about 100 light years less, preferably, of our solar system if we want a high quality photo. In the best case scenario, the first photo will reveal signs of life like vegetation. If we're really lucky and intelligent life exists, we might even detect large-scale infrastructures. But as I tell you from month to month on these updates, after years of searching, astronomers still have not found an exoplanet they believe has Earth-like properties. So Tereshev's plans seem to be going nowhere quick. But He says his mission could launch as early as the 2030s, if NASA gives him the green light. Given, let's say, a 25-year travel time with new, fast, high-tech engines and a few years to gather the data, that means we could conceivably have a high-resolution photo of an alien planet as early as the 2060s. At just about the time when I'll be 100 and, well, my kids will be about as old as I am. It would be about the most ambitious mission ever undertaken, and the odds of success long. But it stands to revolutionize our understanding of the universe and our place in it. If, of course, it actually works. Next story. Albert Einstein? In the news again? Let's stick with space, and another theory that Einstein had about a century ago. In 1915, Einstein realized that his newly formulated general theory of relativity explained a weird quirk in the orbit of Mercury. Now that same effect has been found in the star's orbit of the enormous black hole at the heart of our Milky Way. About 24 astronomers from the Max Planck Institute reported this April 16th in the journal Astronomy and Astrophysics. The star called S2 is part of a stellar entourage that surrounds the Milky Way's central black hole, and for decades researchers have tracked S2's elliptical motion around the black hole. The researchers previously had used observations of S2 to identify a different effect of general relativity, the reddening of the star's light due to what's called a gravitational redshift. Now they've determined that the ellipse rotates over time in what's known as a Schwarzschild precession. A precession is a slow movement of the axis of a spinning body around another axis due to a torquing motion, like a gravitational influence, acting to change the direction of the first axis. That precession is the result of the warping of space-time caused by massive objects, according to general relativity. A similar precession in Mercury's orbit had again stumped scientists before Einstein came along. While physicists have never found a case where general relativity fails, they're searching for any cracks in the theory that could help lead to a new and improved theory of gravity. The new study confirms that Einstein's theory checks out again, even in the intense gravitational environment around a supermassive black hole. Hey, when are you guys going to learn? You got to trust old Al, huh? This is what all the people from Princeton sound like, by the way. Last story of the evening. Let's stick to the outer space theme because, well, at present, the Earth just kind of sucks, if you know what I mean. Pluto! Yes, Pluto finally getting the respect it deserves. Yay, Pluto. All right, not all the respect it deserves, but still. New analysis published this March of images from NASA's New Horizons spacecraft suggests that the dwarf planet has had an underground ocean since shortly after it formed 4.5 billion years ago, and that the ocean may surround and interact with the rocky core. Researcher for the project, Dr. Carver Bearson of the University of California, Santa Cruz, says, quote, "If this is true, oceans could be common at the solar system edge and may even be able to support life there. That possibly transforms the way we think about the Kuiper Belt," unquote. On its pass through the Kuiper Belt in 2015, New Horizons probe revealed that despite the dwarf planet's location, 6 billion kilometers from the sun, Pluto showed signs of hosting an ocean of liquid water beneath an icy shell. Bearson was supposed to present this data on new research related to Pluto at the canceled Lunar and Planetary Science Conference in Woodlands, Texas. However, he has released much of what he was going to talk about. Bearson considered two possible histories for Pluto's potential ocean. If the dwarf planet had a cold start, quote-unquote, any subsurface water would first have been frozen before melting under heat from decaying radioactive elements in the dwarf planet's core, only to partially freeze again over time. In that scenario, Beerson expected to see cracks and ripples across Pluto's icy shell from the orb's contraction as the ice melted and then expansion as the water refroze. Contracting would make the ice crumple into mountain-like features, while expanding would stretch the ice and create faults. Beerson's second scenario envisioned a quote-unquote warm start for Pluto, where the ocean would have been liquid for nearly all of Pluto's 4.5 billion year existence. In that case, the surface would only show cracks from the sea expanding as it partially froze. And that's exactly what Beerson and colleagues found in New Horizons images from Pluto, suggesting that its liquid ocean is nearly as old as the dwarf planet itself. Beerson says, quote, "That means Pluto did start off warm. Maybe it started with a liquid ocean really early on." This lays out one of the coolest hypotheses that a future Pluto mission could test. If Pluto could have an ocean and potentially be habitable, it's very likely that other bodies in the Kuiper Belt are also ocean worlds and also potentially habitable, unquote. Well, that's all for me for now. Stay healthy, stay safe, keep watching the skies. I hope I've inspired some of you. Keep washing those hands until next time. This is Jim Campanella.